Today is Friday and you've reached the Vodcast. On today's Vodcast, we talk with world-renowned microphone expert Klaus Hein. Coming up next.
420 parts per billion. Another glacier gone today. But if you just accept your Lord and Savior, it won't matter in a way.
Started, it tells me the magic of technology on the third try,
the magic of Microsoft. There you go.
Well, you don't hear that very often. Let me give a really quick bio for those people who may not be familiar with you, Klaus. This is from, I just Googled this, so this may be a little bit outdated, but Klaus has crafted and recorded the sound of cultural icons such as Barbara Streisand, Whitney Houston, Lenny Kravitz, Steve Perry from Journey, as well as that of legendary film studios in scoring stages, Lucasfilm, Paramount Studios, and Disney, among others. Born in Berlin, Klaus studied law in Frankfurt and apprenticed as a luthier, which is an interesting combination. We'll have to talk more about that. In the 70s, he immigrated to the United States, settling in San Francisco. From a guitar repairman and later owner of a luthier shop in San Francisco in the early 80s, he became an importer of vintage German tube microphones to the U.S. Since 1987, he has specialized in the repair, restoration, and upgrade of fine European recording microphones for studios, producers, artists, voice talent. In 1991, Klaus relocated to Columbia Gorge, Oregon, and is currently writing the Vintage Microphone Handbook. Klaus's company is German Masterworks. Klaus Hein, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Have you finished the Vintage Microphone Handbook?
Oh, that's an interesting story that is so telling about the radical changes in even in publishing. Hal Leonard would have been the publisher, a big music publishing house. They sent me a nice fat advance, and then I started writing the book. And as that happened, Google search pretty much took over what Hal Leonard wanted from me, namely an encyclopedia of what microphone was made when, and you know, when was that introduced. And then I said, look, let's do something else here. Why don't we do a much more subjective accounting of my personal interpretation of what is a good sound in a microphone, what is not so good, how are successful artists using microphones, and on and on. And then they say, well, you know, we can't do this because we are also within ownership change, and we would also like to issue a CD with data on it. And I said, you know what, let's just do it like Sammy Hagar did with his famous book Red, a bestseller. He was basically interviewed in his living room for 5 weekends by Joel Salvin, the culture critic of the San Francisco Chronicle. A fantastic book. So Joel Salvin then just edited it together. And it's just a gripping book. I recommend anybody, even if you're not into rock and roll, to read that book. And that's kind of what I suggested to Hal Leonard. And they said, no, you know what? We want to stay with a coffee table kind of stuff. And I said, look, here's your money back. Thank you very much. That was that.
Well, that was my question for you, is did you get to keep the big fat advance? It sounds like you gave it back.
I did. It wouldn't be ethical to just keep that. If I don't deliver it, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, that's good. It's the entertainment business, you know, funny things happen. But Sammy Hagar has found a lot of different ways to make money. That is an ambitious, high-energy guy who, along with being a great singer and musician, has really maintained his relevance in a market over decades, in a market that's really hard to, you know, maintain your relevance. So he's quite the person. I don't know him, but I didn't know that he wrote a bestseller.
It's called Red. And you know what's funny is how Sammy Hagar really made the money to buy a Ford jet engine that he flies himself. He sold the tequila company. Mouet Chandon, the big conglomerate, approached him and said, name your price. And Sammy, this is the highlight for me in the book. And Sammy said, you know what, but I'm just going to give him a number of $1 billion. And Moët and Chandon came back. They said, okay, done. That's how he made his money, by selling his tequila company that he founded in Cabo, you know?
So, yeah, that's a great story. So you are known as, you know, the world foremost expert on vintage microphones, specifically Neumann's. And one question I've had is, does that extend to Telefunken's and AKG's? Have you specialized more in the Neumann's than the other manufacturers?
Well, let's separate that out. Telefunken never made any microphones. Telefunken was a marketing company. And initially, Telefunken, a marketing company for all kinds of electrical stuff, from stoves to tape recorders to loudspeakers. And Telefunken would normally do what's called a key installation, where they demanded that any studio, which were very few in the 1950s in Europe, that would equip their with these items, the Telefunken badge needed to be put on it. So Telefunken put its badge on Beyer microphones, AKG microphones, Neumann microphones, Sennheiser microphones. It didn't matter. That was just, they never made anything. The very famous Telefunken 251 microphone, that is one of the big five and the all-time greats ever made, is an AKG microphone. And Telefunken basically said, look, we like your current offering. It looks a little slender on television. Can we make it a little sexier looking? So the AKG guys went to work, made the body a little bigger, made a beautiful greenish, grayish, shiny housing tube that is just iconic to this day. And thus was born the Elam 251, which is under the hood pretty much an C12 AKG microphone.
Huh. I did not know that. That's fascinating. What about today? Telefunken, you know, still makes very expensive modern microphones.
Oh, an incredible story. I'm so glad you asked about it. Telefunken went under, was sold, the remnants of the business and the trademark was sold to Mercedes-Benz in the 1970s, I think. Mercedes-Benz sat on this for a long time. Tony Fishman in Connecticut said, let's buy that trademark. Let's just see what we can do. They figured out to buy the trademark and the name and the diamond shape symbol that is considered with Telefunken. And eventually they started making a copy of that famous Telefunken microphone. This is insidious now in the industry, that companies that go out of business, other deep pockets buy trademarks and reissue stuff. Another classic example is the famous Mollard and Tongsol tubes, which were iconic in terms of high quality tubes for anything, preamps, hi-fi equipment, microphones. Mike Matthews of New Sensor in New York basically went after the wall came down to Russia, bought the companies, picked up the trademark names, and now sells these tubes as if they were the real thing. It is incredibly confusing, and nobody's defending the original trademarks because the companies went out of business. And I have a big issue with Neumann. I'm a consultant for Neumann, and I have a big issue with them. I said, why did you guys not trademark these important things, these iconic names like M7, U67, M49, on and on? They said, well, we missed the boat. Once they are in public circulation, you can no longer trademark anything or patent anything. It's over. So it's a rearward fight that they're all fighting now. And it confuses even people like you who seem to know a little bit about this stuff, right? You think there is such a thing as a Telefunken microphone, when in effect it is a copy company that bought it's like a Louis Vuitton handbag that is basically made in somewhere else, you know, not really.
It brings me to the question about what you think of them. The current day version of the Elam 251, for example, John McBride from Blackbird in Nashville would say, you know, you want a great vocal sound, go get a 251 and pair it with a TubeTech CL1B, and you've got yourself a great vocal sound. And I don't think he's always talking about necessarily a vintage 251. I think he means off the shelf, you know, and those are $11,000 microphones today, those new Telefunkens. What do you think of the quality of the current Telefunken Elam 251? Hey,
the Big Five, the all-time greatest microphones ever made in the 1950s and 60s, all rest on a three-legged stool of quality components. And even if one of those legs isn't there, the whole thing collapses. The three legs are the capsule, the tube, and the transformer. That, let's just talk capsules for a second. Neumann is really smart. There's three people in the whole company that knows the process of making a capsule. A capsule is not easily or at all reverse engineerable. The Chinese can take a capsule, take it apart, but they do not know the process that was necessary to put that thing together. Meaning, the aging, the tempering, the tensioning, the oven. When do you start the process? How long do you keep the oven on to temper the diaphragm? How many weights do you put on the diaphragm to get the tension? On and on and on and on. So it's basically the Coca-Cola formula for Neumann. And so they don't give that away, right? And that's why nobody right now, AKG went out of business. That fantastic capsule design is lost forever anyway. But Neumann still makes those capsules. And they try to duplicate this stuff, and it can't be done. It's mediocre at best, two-dimensional, pedestrian-sounding stuff. And God knows how Neumann was smart enough to never change the formula. Since, example, U67, one of the flagship microphones of the company, unchanged, that capsule is unchanged to this current day. Same form factor, same everything, unchanged. So you can easily put a currently made U67 capsule in a vintage U67 from 1963 and vice versa. And you can put an old capsule into one of the UE issues. So I forgot the question. Repeat the question.
Yes. I don't remember the question either. No, the question was, do you think the Telefunken Elam 251 is a very high-end, great-sounding mic? You know, that
you mean the copy?
The current. Yeah, the current $11,000 through Sweetwater version.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think it is. It is. Anytime I demonstrated a good a well kept specimen or well working specimen, original one to that, it's just. And you know what? The funny thing about this is, I was just thinking about this the other day, because there's these people on forums saying, "Hey, it just sounds like exactly like the original one," blah blah blah. And I'm thinking, if you asked any of these people that say that, would you, if you had all the money in the world and he had a choice of getting an original one or a reissue. And by the way, you cannot sell it, meaning you cannot make any money on it, but just for usage, just in the studio, which one would you choose? Do you think a single person would use the copy? No.
You know, Klaus, I think people most people that are going to be listening to this know what I'm about to say, but some won't. So for those people that are just interested in Klaus and I having a chat, the majority of records that are made to this day, all the biggest records you're listening to, they're still using microphones from 1950 and 60. So they're not
absolutely
using
true.
So that's
absolutely true. And they have all the money in the world. And the funny thing is, nobody will ever see the microphones. It's not even a prestige thing that you sell more if you use an old microphone. No, but it sounds better. And you know, let's dig a little deeper into what this is all about. You know, ultimately, a microphone, in my opinion, is in service to a sensory perception, the perception of sound, right? And as such, it has to be designed with constant feedback from the senses. It's a schizophrenic task for any current engineer who relies only on data in the design process, right? So an electrical engineer receives little or no oral training, hearing training, which explains some of the missteps in recording microphone technology development through the last few decades. You know, there is a three-dimensionality. This is words are incredibly primitive to describe sensory functions, whether it's, you know, olfactory or visual or even oral. So if I say three-dimensional, what do I mean? If you listen to I don't know what, a classic Nat King Cole record or a classic Barbara Streisand record or even something current that, let's say, Rick Rubin produced in Malibu or Jackson Browne or whatever. There is a third dimension. There is something that is an emotional draw that you can't explain with your left brain. It is strictly a right brain perception, meaning you are either drawn into the music or you're not. And a good microphone is able to facilitate that. A mediocre microphone, you immediately then go to your left brain and say, oh, interesting, good frequency, it's a little hot at 8,000 hertz, and, you know, but otherwise, you know, good dynamic. None of this stuff matters in the end. If you are already deviating from your right brain into analysis, the battle is already lost. So good microphones, they draw you in. They just draw you in. And let's talk. I mean, this is not woo-woo. This is not something that is esoteric to the point of defying analysis. It's a very simple thing. We talked earlier about these components that current companies don't have access to or don't want to pay for. Let's take a transformer. A transformer is basically a device in a microphone that couples the divergent or different stages of impedances, meaning resistance variables within a device. So you do this with a transformer that has a primary winding and a secondary winding, so that in the end, when you plug this thing into your microphone preamplifier or your mixing console, noise comes out, and hopefully beautiful, round, full frequency noise. So what has happened in that field? Well, transformer technology went out of business in the 1960s because op amps were designed. Transistor technology came on. People were throwing away their tube microphones. You mentioned earlier the beginning of my career in microphones. I would pick up M49 microphones from public broadcast stations in Germany for 50 euros. They were just out of... Transistor technology was the new god. Everybody said, let's transistorize, you know. Not unlike maybe now digital technology is the new god. But that meant that you didn't need transformers anymore. That meant that eventually the people would age out, would retire, and the knowledge was lost. There's a few books still out, and I gave one of those new young Turks that are trying to revive this technology. I gave him one of those books. It's a book of 1,000 pages. And guess what? It doesn't even deal with transformer technology. It just deals with one aspect of transformer technology, annealing, the tempering of the metal components in a, you know, the core material of a transformer are laminates, metal laminates. And it's incredibly important how you temper those so that there's a linear response for when you chase audio through it, right? All that stuff got lost. I mentioned earlier capsule technology, right? Same thing, secret sauce. It's not magic, but that the deep knowledge has gotten lost because transformers fell out of favor. So now you are at the point where you have to deal with mediocre capsules, mediocre transformers, tubes, that's another factor. The old tubes of the 1960s were incredibly sophisticated devices. If you hold an old tube next to a current Russian-made tube, more mica spaces, much more complicated construction. It's too expensive. So that brings up another factor why this stuff doesn't happen anymore. We are now in a global market. A global market means race to the bottom in terms of cost. So current microphones are only made along two guidelines. That is either automation, fully automated circuit design, meaning SMT technology, no more hand soldering of anything. And that's for American and for European products, and or Chinese products that are, you know, cheaply made because labor cost is still pretty inexpensive in Asia. And so the third part, the top of the line part, is currently vacant. Neumann went back into it. Thank God. We can talk about this in a little while. But they said, wait a minute, we're losing market share to this mediocre crap, to these copy companies. And we don't want that, you know, but we can talk about that a little later. But that's one of the reasons why, or some of the reasons why, current microphone technology is not comparable in terms of its sonic output to that of the 1950s or 60s or the Big Five.
And you mentioned you were picking up M49s for 50 euros, so $60 or something. You know, whatever that was, probably 35, 40 years ago. And I know the answer to this, but what does that same M49 Neumann sell for today?
In good shape, between $30,000 and $40,000.
Yeah. So, you know, one piece you mentioned about the price and how the global economy is driving price down, which is true in every sector that I'm aware of. But with microphones, they're, you know, it's not like these top-end new microphones are cheap. I had mentioned the Telefunken 251 is an $11,000 mic, brand new. The Neumann M49V or 5 that you worked on with, you consulted with Neumann on, that's an $8,000 or $9,000 mic or something retail. So it's not like these microphones are inexpensive, but can they just not get the quality, the absolute highest quality part that would bring them close to that 1960s version? And if that's true, how do you feel about your new M49? Because I read your article on it, the Neumann M49. Is it 5 or V?
V, like vintage.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. First question first. It's the same answer again. People don't have access to good parts. They don't exist anymore. You can design, let's take one component, a coupling capacitor, which is a device where all of audio has to get through in a microphone and come out alive on the other end without any DC left over, meaning just the audio, just the AC has to get through. An incredibly complicated task and not easily done. You can put into a microphone a $20 part, which I do in my modifications, or you can put into the microphone, a brand new microphone, an $8,000 or $11,000 microphone, a 50-cent part, which is currently done. So it's an economy of scale too, because if you add all this up, what it would cost, you end up quickly past $20,000. There is currently no longer a market for that. And I tell you, I don't think Telefunken sells many 251s for $11,000 each. Look at the used prices for those. They drop quickly. The market has changed. This is another interesting. This is almost like the perfect storm. Why we are where we are. The consumer market has changed. There were no when the Big Five were made in the 1950s and 1960s. There was no home recording. None. It didn't exist. It was institutional only, and 90% governments subsidized into institutions, broadcast stations, state-run broadcast stations in Austria and Germany, and maybe 10% turnkey operations in Sweden, one in England, two. You know, very, very little of this private studio. Abbey Road was one of those. You know, and then, as the stuff got cheaper, it's the same with cameras. As the stuff got cheaper, that market was serviced above anything else because it was the only growth market. Today, 90%, my guess, I can't give you concrete numbers, but I would say a overwhelming majority of buyers of recording microphones, in this case, are bedroom recordists. That's the market. And so it's not going to be easy if Telefunken USA, that copy company, wouldn't sell huge amounts of $300 and $500, you know, hobby microphones. I don't think they could sustain themselves in that rarefied segment that they're also trying to please. Neumann is somewhat a different story because Neumann is owned by a $3 billion company, Sennheiser. Sennheiser makes its money with institutional PA stuff. Anytime you go in Europe in an airport and you hear these clear sounds coming over the loudspeakers, it's a Sennheiser installation, right? So they make huge amounts of money with installations. But then they bought Neumann. They took over Neumann. And so they said, okay, you guys can continue doing what you want on under one condition. Don't give us red figures. Don't be in the minus. So Neumann kept their word, kept supplemented the really expensive flagships with fairly entry level small diaphragm microphones, vocal microphones. I'm talking right now through a KMS-105 vocal stage microphone, right? So that's their bread and butter. So the hand wired, hand soldered human touch microphones are probably a relatively small column in their balance sheet.
That's the M49 vintage, for example, the new one.
Yeah, M49, U67. I don't know whether your listeners are that versed with this stuff, but basically Neumann became famous with three microphones. One was the famous U47, Nat King Cole, Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, M49, Barbara Streisand, Miles Davis, Nora Jones, Neil Diamond, and U67. Anything from recording Eric Clapton's Blues Breaker recordings with it to this is the ubiquitous universal microphone used on literally anything until the transistor microphones came out. So
what do you, I've read the article, but you know, the new vintage, I'm especially interested in the M49 vintage. How do you feel that quality is in from a sound perspective to the originals?
And I get the question a lot, and actually I do work on those quite a bit, because what I do offer is indeed a Barbara Streisand modification. As you may know, I modified those for Barbara Streisand to bring out certain qualities and suppress others in her voice. You can, with those incredibly healthy bones of that reissue, the M49V, with a little bit of tweaking, get a sound out of that microphone that is indistinguishable from the very best M49s from the late 1950s and early 1960s. They did a fantastic job. The build quality is exceptional. They adhered to the same circuitry, which is not unimportant, identical circuitry. Although they couldn't find any more of the original tubes that were made, they substituted with a tube that I cannot with my ears distinguish from the original. So a lot of love and care went into this. This is not a company that is a bottom line company when it comes to designing. The new CEO of the company really understands it. What the previous CEO called, "We will not revisit the past," the new CEO says, "Yes, we will revisit the past, because we cannot neglect how we got big, and we need to serve that market." It's a smaller market, and there's no question about it. You know, like I mentioned, 90% of the people will not have the money for such a microphone. But you still need a flagship. Mercedes still has a flagship, even if they're selling the mid-price E by the thousands more than the S-Class. But you have to have a flagship to keep that glory, that sheen over the company.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard great things. I'm looking forward to trying an M49V. I'm going to be in Nashville in a couple of weeks, and hopefully I'll get a chance. I don't know if Vintage King will have them or not, but I'll look around a little bit down there. Well, the last thing I have for you, Klaus, you've told me that in addition to being an expert in microphones, you are a relationship expert.
Well, you know, it's more like a joke. I often consult for hours sometimes with clients, right? And they say, "Oh, so happy, and you know, thank you so much, and you're such a." I said, "You know, why don't you ask me about my marital advice sometimes?" You know, I mean, as a joke, right? All right, I leave you with one piece of relationship advice, okay? That I'm sincerely believing in. I would say, spend quality time alone, by yourself, away from your mate and reconnect with yourself as an individual, outside of constantly referring to yourself through a shared perspective, and thereby neglecting a vital part of, you know, what makes you an individual.
Well, Sian, that's great advice. It has been an honor to talk to you, sir. Thank you much so much for your time. And for all of those people out there listening, you are listening to the Kelly Moore Podcast.
But if you just accept your Lord and Savior, it won't matter in a way. And we'll win in a race to the bottom. And it don't seem like no one's gonna stop us. Choose yesterday. Just give these people say.